Chapter 3. The Father.
The voyage across the sea on one of my father's merchant ships took 3 days, or 3 weeks, or 3 months. 3 moments, 3 eternities, 3 times to learn. The cabin I shared with my father, his cabin on his ship, was small, simply furnished, and fitted the austere personality that my father had made himself to be, or had made himself up to be. 10 by 12 feet, a bed, a bench, a table, 2 chairs, a cupboard, a chest of drawers, a washstand, a door, a small porthole near the ceiling, an oil lamp, 2 chamber pots, a flap next to the door for putting them out when they were filled, blankets, a few pillows, some plates, cups, and cutlery, a jar with water, a bottle with wine, a huge trunk with our baggage. The furniture, the floor, the walls, and the ceiling were from the same wood, nondescript, dark, sturdy, stained. This was our room. For the whole voyage, except for one occasion, one that I would have preferred to avoid, this was where I stayed, to where I was confined.
3 lessons you will have to learn, my father told me, after we had come aboard and settled into our cabin. 3 lessons, 3 skills I needed to possess before becoming the wife, if only temporarily, of the most powerful man in the empire. I took off my clothes, and my father locked them into the trunk. The first skill I had to learn was how to please a man. So far, my father had often enough pleased himself with me, and in various ways, but on these occasions all I had to do was to allow him the unimpeded use of my body, and not to interfere with his seeking of pleasures. This was, I think, what he preferred, not only from me, but from any woman he sexually employed. But more than silently indulging passivity would be expected from the Khan's wife. And, whatever his personal preferences were, my father was competent enough as a teacher. The sea was calm. I hardly felt the movements of the ship. I ate, I slept, I learned. I hardly felt the passing of time. What I learned was to use each single part of my body for a man's sexual benefit. My fingers, fingertips, fingernails, toes, toenails, hands and feet, arms, ankles and thighs, my hair, my forehead, my eyelids, eyelashes, cheeks, nose, lips, teeth, tongue, my throat, my shoulders, my armpits, my nipples, my breasts, my belly, my back, my ass, my vulva, my vagina. I learned to use them tenderly and with force, to do the expected and the unexpected, to grip and to release, to give and to withhold, to arouse, to tease, to satisfy, and to arouse again, while never, ever seeking gratification for myself or allowing it to happen. This sometimes seemed the hardest part, though at other times it was easy enough. The only male body, the only penis to practice with, was my father's. The sailors and the captain could not contribute to my education, because I had to remain pure for my future husband. My father had brought a small blue flacon from which, unless it was time for us to rest, he poured a few drops of a colourless liquid into the palm of his left hand and licked it up after he had ejaculated, which allowed him to continue my lessons with little interruptions. He told me, but only once, that this potion put a great strain on his body, that it drained his life from him, that it could cost him years of his life, that he was doing it for me. Not feeling grateful to him would have been unkind. The second skill that I had to learn to make me a worthy wife for the Khan, after I had sufficiently mastered the first one, was to bear pain without flinching. After I had mastered the first part of my education to my teacher's sufficient satisfaction, the second part seemed to demand very little from me. My father would not do any damage to my body that might still be visible when I would be handed over to the Khan, so the pain I had to bear was mostly that of needles, even if my father knew how to use them with good effect. Upon my nipples, my clitoris, or underneath my toe and fingernails. I had to learn, he told me, to stay still, without movement, without a sound, when the pain threatened, when it approached, when it set in, when it grew and lasted and did not stop growing. But staying still was what I had already learned, what had filled a major part of my life. All those years since he had first taken me to see the bay. And pain, I shrugged it off, it was just pain. An opinion held by a part of my mind, which I simply disagreed with, disengaged from, as I had learned to do over the years in my fighting lessons, of which my father had never known. But then, just before I felt complacency to set in at how easily I mastered this task, just before I began to wonder if by not showing a need to learn, I might be upsetting my father's educational program, and if, for his benefit, I should let him hear a suppressed moan every now and then, or let him see an involuntary, ever so tiny twitch of my face or my hands, or whatever part of my body his needles were about to go in. Just then I learned that I had to learn, after all.
It's no good if you block out the pain, he said. You have to admit it, allow it, feel it, and still not flinch.
And then, when he held the tip of an awl against my exposed clit, when he slowly but steadily increased the pressure, when his arms strained, when the old slightly bent tip carved a deepening dent into me where it hurt most, when it finally broke through the skin and entered me and twisted and entered deeper and kept twisting, then I allowed the pain, and it washed over me in a sea of flaming agony, engulfed my whole body, overwhelmed me with its unexpectedness, turned me inside out, washed me away, threw me against a rock of splintered glass and let me lie with broken bones and a broken mind. And I welcomed it, and embraced it, and invited it in, and clung to it, and refused to let it go. And when, after a far too long eternity, the flames had subsided and my mind and body had again composed themselves, and I found myself where I had been before it had started, my father said,
"You closed your eyes for a moment, but otherwise you have done well."
"Let me try again," I said, and he let me. If I could have chosen one of the three lessons to avoid, it would have been the third one. Not because my father said it would be the hardest. I knew it wouldn't be that hard for me, but it was a lesson I didn't feel I needed. And this made it seem so pointless, such a waste. From the cargo of 24 slave girls, I had to choose one who would die. Slowly and painfully, while the others had to watch, and while I would watch too. Now that I had learned to bear my own pain, according to my father, I had to learn to bear that of others.
"But they are your merchandise," I said to him in a pointless attempt at dissuasion. "They are valuable, aren't they?"
"Less than you are," my father replied. "You are worth the expenditure. Education comes at a price. What do you think Elmer Guest has cost me?
For a short moment, I thought he meant he had bought him, but he was talking about my tutor's fee all those years. But I suddenly understood at this moment the Khan had bought me. My price certainly covered my upbringing, my education, the part my father had ordered, and the part he didn't know about, and a hefty surcharge. I had been an investment which had paid off, or would pay off if the Khan was satisfied with the deal. A dead slave girl was a negligible quantity in this business. When he asked me if I was ready, I said yes, and we went. It was the first time that I left our cabin since we had come aboard. My father did not want me to be naked in front of the crew. I put on a simple white linen dress. I hadn't taken much clothing with me, or much of anything. I knew that slaves often suffered terrible conditions on board of merchant ships, but on this ship this was not the case, at least not for the girls. The cabin in which they were kept was some 10 feet wide and 50 feet long, and it was above the waterline. On one side it had portholes through which light and fresh air came in. On each of the long sides there was a bench on which 12 girls were sitting next to each other, naked, of course, their wrists chained to bolts above their heads, their ankles chained to bolts on the floor, their mouths gagged. All but one, that is, who was their minder. Except during the night watch, she was unchained, and she had a key to the locks, not to the door, of course, and one girl after the other, 3 times a day, was unchained by her for 15 minutes, during which she could take out her gag, stretch out her cramped limbs, sit down on a small table at one end of the cabin to a mug of water and a bowl of not very appetizing but nourishing mush, relieve herself over a hole at the opposite end, and, once a day, clean herself head to toes with a wet towel. The sailors were not allowed to touch them. All they could do was watch them through several small windows, and only the captain and the officers, every now and then, entered the cabin to enhance a chained girl's diet with their sperm. And in this cabin I stood now, accompanied by my father and several of the sailors. It struck me how similar the girls looked. Long black hair, white skin, supple limbs, slim waists, large firm breasts. They looked as if someone had chosen a model and ordered 2 dozens of the same type. Maybe this was how it was, or maybe it was just this year's fashion in girls. Only their faces were different, and their expressions. They knew why we were here, why I was here. I should have chosen quickly, randomly, to get it over with, but I looked from one to the other. In some faces I saw defiance, in some I saw apathy, in some I saw fear, in some I saw sorrow or even tears. Some seemed to be close to fainting. Some avoided my eyes, some looked down, some looked at me pleadingly, some stoically, some tried to charm me with a smile. It was not only death I'd bring to one of them, but hours. Many hours of unspeakable agony. The silence stretched. "This one," I finally said, pointing to the one whose sad, despondent expression had told me that she had already known, had always known, that the choice would fall upon her. The men unchained her and removed her gag. Then they gave her a potion to drink that would paralyze her vocal cords. Her screams would be silent. While we waited for the potion to take effect, she knelt before us, thin, pale, slightly trembling, resigned. One of the men pinched her nipple, hard, and she opened her mouth, but only a light wheezing sound came out of it. It was time then, and she knew it. And her soundless scream rang in my ears, and in that of the other girls. About the men's ears, I do not know. The first thing they did was to break her arms and legs. Then they laid her down on the floor. Only now I saw how dark with stains it was, and began to rape her. Some of them not paying attention whether they caused agony in her broken limbs, others paying attention and deliberately straining and twisting them. And when they were through, the others came and raped her, one after the other. And by the time they were through, some of the first ones had already regained their strength and raped her anew. And then, when they had satisfied themselves, they brought out their knives. Strange knives with blades that were curved at their ends, sharp-edged on the inner sides of the curves. And, wielding them like huge claws, not stopping the rapes, they began to cut her, to rip her apart. Slowly, expertly, not letting her die. Not yet. Not yet. "You can stop it," my father said, had already said it before it had begun. He sat next to me. We had been given two stools to sit on. He did not participate in the rapes and tortures.
"You can stop her pain, her torture, at any time, by simply walking away. When you leave, she dies. She suffers only as long as you stay and watch her suffer."
Hours passed. She tried not to move, as every movement increased her agony. She could not scream or speak, but her eyes spoke of her pain. I did not walk away, because I knew it was a test. Learning my lesson meant I had to stay, and meant that I had to understand that I had to stay. Had I failed, the lesson would have been repeated with a different girl. But I also did not walk away because, as I had known, it was not that hard for me to pass this test. In the books from my father's library, without flinching, I had seen worse. By the time that the potion began to lose its effect, she was too weak to make much sound, and ultimately, her eyes now gone too, she became unresponsive to the men, the blades, and the pain, and, at last, they carried her away. To the galley, I suppose, where the cook would find a final use for her. And they wiped the blood from the floor. It was too late in the day now to have the girls unchained, one after the other, so they missed the day's noon and evening meals. But the one who was their minder went to each one now with a cup and gave her water to drink, and cleaned up under her if she had not been able to contain her bowels. None of them looked at me now. Did they detest me for having caused the death of one of theirs? Did they silently thank me for having chosen her and spared them? Had the many hours of the agonizing spectacle drained all emotions from them? They did not turn their heads as my father and I left their cabin and returned to our own, where a meal waited for us, and the night. The remaining days of the voyage were mostly spent in silence. I had learned my lessons, or given a good enough impression of having learned them. There was nothing more on my father's agenda. He did not seem to be inclined to talk about the future that awaited me, or about any other topic, and neither was I. Among the few possessions I had with me, if they still were my possessions, if they ever had been, there were a few books, and I spent the time reading. We arrived on a late evening. I saw little of the harbour, except that it was big, and I saw even less, or nothing, of the town. My father led me directly from our cabin to a carriage that waited for us where the ship had docked, and in which we were the only passengers. The windows were hung with dark drapes as we drove from the harbour to the Khan's palace. It was for my future husband to show me his country, his town, or whatever parts of them he might choose for me to see, if he chose so. It was for him to decide where I would be, what I would do, what would be done with me, and what I would get to see, and some of it, without a doubt, would not be pleasant. We left the carriage in a dark hall, where mine and my father's ways separated. A valet led me to my room. It was larger than our cabin on the ship, but windowless, and even more sparsely furnished. Comfortable enough for a prison cell, though. A cup with water on a small table, a candle, a chair, a chamber pot, a bed. I drank the water, put my dress on the chair, used the chamber pot, blew out the candle, and lay down upon the bed to sleep. I did not know when the wedding would be, assuming there would be an official ceremony, but I knew that the Khan would call for me in the morning. They would give me breakfast and a chance to wash before bringing me into him, wouldn't they?